It takes a lot of nutrients to make a tree grow, and it takes a huge amount of nutrients to make a tree grow as big as a giant sequoia in California. Some of those nutrients are imported, it turns out. A recently published paper shows how dust traveling all the way from the Gobi Desert in China ends up in California, providing nutrients that help the likes of the giant sequoia trees grow. We have one of the co-authors of the paper here with us to talk about the journey of the dust and the journey to understand that journey. Emma Aronson is an assistant professor in the Department of Plant Pathology and Microbiology at the University of California, Riverside, and she joins us by phone from there. Dr. Aronson, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you so very much for having me.
So the findings themselves are plenty interesting, but what made you think to even look?
To look at the dust that was coming in altogether, you mean?
Sure. I mean, what was the original spur for the research?
You know, it's very interesting. The research was part of an effort by what's called a critical zone observatory. So the National Science Foundation funds groups of interdisciplinary scientists to work together at 10 locations around the country. So we were located in the Southern Sierra. It's the Southern Sierra CZO, or Critical Zone Observatory. So that's really the only reason that this group of scientists even got together. The fact that we were put together, we started talking and started thinking from our different perspectives about what kind of questions there were to ask about the Sierra Nevada. And there's a lot of different questions we could ask. But you know, all of us sort of separately came at this question of dust moving into the Sierras. My main interest was about microorganisms that could be coming in with that dust, which we haven't published that data yet. One of our other co-authors had been looking at the nutrients in the Sierras, and he'd found that there was a deficit of a really important nutrient called phosphorus. So he was really interested in looking into the possibility of phosphorus coming in on dust. Another co-author was really interested in looking at the isotopes of the dust and understanding where it was coming from. Another co-author was really interested in looking at the importance of the dust to the plants of the ecosystem of the Sierras.
So a lot of different things that you guys could accomplish with,
yeah,
with one good sweep of research, it sounds
exactly,
like.
Exactly.
So how important is phosphorus to plant growth, and how big is the deficit in the Sierra?
That's a great question. So phosphorus is incredibly important to plant growth. I know some of your listeners might do some gardening on their own, and if you buy a standard fertilizer from a store, it's going to often have three main nutrients. It'll have nitrogen, it'll have phosphorus, and it'll have potassium. NPK is how that might be indicated on the bag. You know, I think it's important to think about that because it's an important nutrient. It's also one that plants often have trouble accessing by themselves. They work with a network of microorganisms, in particular fungi, to get those nutrients, in particular phosphorus, from the soil. It's incredibly important to plants, and there's a deficit in the Sierras, mostly because there isn't a lot of phosphorus in the bedrock below the soils. It's pretty low phosphorus, low nutrient bedrock. It's a granite, and it just doesn't have a lot of what the plants need. So even though there's constantly a refreshing of the soil there because of erosion bringing old soils away from the mountains, weathering, microbial and also just, you know, chemical and physical weathering happening on the bedrock there to create new soil, there's just not much nutrient coming out of that bedrock. And that's usually where plants get a lot of their nutrients from, is from the weathering of the rock that's below the soil.
It sounds almost like serpentine soil in the lack of nutrients for plants.
It's not quite that bad. Mm-hmm. we're not quite there. Serpentine soil also just has a lot of contaminating compounds that when the serpentine breaks down, the rock breaks down, you get soil that's kind of toxic. So it's not like that in any way. It's just that it's low nutrient. That's a great question.
So given the lowness of the lack of phosphorus in the soil there, I mean, how big would you normally expect plants to get in that ecosystem?
Well, that's been part of the conundrum. You know, we didn't study in any way specifically the giant sequoia, but they are a part of a complex forest ecosystem that's different at various elevations in the Sierras. In general, the plants are a lot bigger than what we would expect. And I can't give an exact number. That's not my area of focus, you know, and how big the plants would be. But, you know, in general, not nearly as big or as many plants would be able to be sustained as what we see today.
Okay, so then what did you do to test the hypothesis? What sort of tests did you run to take a look at where dust came from and how big a contribution it made?
So what we did was we actually put together what we call dust collectors at four elevations in the Sierras. We started out down in the foothills. in an oak woodland savanna, sort of an open canopy, a few oak trees and some grassland. And then we went all the way up to about 10,000 feet in a subalpine forest. And what we found was, let me just explain what those dust collectors look like. So what we put together is a really interesting lo-fi, low-tech solution. We had bundt pans, which we then filled with marbles that were suspended by a net over the bottom of the pan. And what that allows for is as wind blows dust in, either, you know, from anywhere, it's going to, those particles are going to settle on the marbles. And as a new gust of wind comes by, if you didn't have any marbles, if you just had an open pan, let's say, those dust particles could really easily just blow out. What the marbles do is they allow for those dust particles to bounce around and eventually get dropped further and further into the collector so that they can stay until we come by and we get them out. We use water just to wash the particles out of the collectors, and then we brought that back to analyze it. So it's really interesting. It's just sort of a homemade solution. It was originally created by Maris Rehais, a woman who worked at the U.S. Geological Survey, and it's a great design that we adapted for this study.
And I want to be clear, too, you did say bundt pan, as in what you cook a bundt cake in.
We literally had to order them from Amazon. They're Teflon lined, just like you would use for nonstick. It turns out that's great for being able to use for isotopes because the metal isn't directly interacting with the dust, so that's good. The Teflon kind of creates this nice barrier, and also to be able to look at microbial communities, we can relatively easily sterilize that Teflon and then put it out and allow the microbes and the dust to collect. So the bundt pans, exactly what you would bake in.
Emma Aronson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an assistant professor in the Department of Plant Pathology and Microbiology at the University of California, Riverside, one of the authors of a paper that showed that dust from the Gobi Desert blows all the way over to California and provides nutrients to plants there, including the giant sequoias. The paper title is Dust Outpaces Bedrock and Nutrient Supply to Montane Forest Ecosystems. It's in the journal Nature Communications. You can join the conversation here on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. No questions about where to order bundt pans, please. Once you've got the dust collected and you've washed them out of the collectors and have taken them someplace, what does the analysis go to then?
Great question. The lead author of this paper, Sarah Asiego, my colleague, who was at University of Michigan at the time of the study, she would then essentially she would dry out the dust because we used water to collect it, and then she would analyze the total mass of dust. She would also do some pretty interesting analyses of the isotopic composition, the isotopic ratios of certain rare earth elements. The reason for that is that other scientists over the course of many years have established the isotopic composition of these exact same elements all over the world. We know what the soil composition looks like in the Gobi Desert, for example. We know what it looks like in the Sahara Desert and other regions of the world. And so we're able to compare the dust that we were collecting in the Sierras to those known ratios and figure out where do we fall. What we figured out was actually that the isotopic ratio of the dust that we were collecting at the highest elevation, it was about halfway between the signal we should see from the Gobi Desert and the signal we should see from the from the Central Valley, which is adjacent to the Sierras, just west of the Sierras. And both of those sources were potential sources we knew about, but we didn't realize that we'd be really seeing half and half, that the dust is to a certain extent local. It's coming from just below in the Central Valley. In particular, we studied during a drought year, so we were expecting a good amount of dust coming from the Central Valley. But it's amazing that it was able to blow all the way up to 10,000 feet, and it was amazing that we found dust particles from as far away as the Gobi Desert.
So I want to get back to the isotopic composition.
Sure.
Now, really, it sounds like a fingerprint. I mean, you can just get some dust and say, okay, based on what's in this dust, it probably came from this place.
That's exactly right, and it's such a wonderful technique. She's actually, Sarah Asiego, she's an incredible scientist, and she's really one of the only people. There's a few. I'm not saying she's the only one, but she's part of a few scientists who are able to work with very, very small amounts of material, in particular dust. You can't get a lot at any one time probably a good thing. We don't want a ton of dust blowing around in the air. But she was able to work with these small amounts of dust and it essentially do just that, fingerprint where it was coming from. It's an incredible technology.
So I've got no idea here of travel time. I mean, did the dust that made the current trees big arrive centuries or even millennia ago? I mean, how long does it take to get from the Gobi Desert to the High Sierra?
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. You're asking a great question. It's really two different things. So the first is just how long does it take for dust to get from the Gobi Desert to the Sierras? And it's not long. I think it's on the order of weeks to months. It's not a huge amount of time. It's moving relatively fast in very high altitude wind. The other component, though, is the trees that we see now, they would have really been more reliant on dust when they were getting established, when they were growing to their towering heights. They're still relying on the dust nutrients right now, but what we're seeing now, there's no reason to believe it's very different from what would have happened a few hundred years ago when some of these trees were just starting out. I think the dust that was coming in then is probably from a similar source to what we're seeing now, and it has contributed a lot of nutrients to allow them to grow to these huge heights.
Gobi Desert dust arriving in the California Sierra, helping the plants there grow where there's not as much natural phosphorus is the basic issue we're talking about here with Emma Aronson, an assistant professor in the Department of Plant Pathology and Microbiology at the University of California, Riverside. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Have a call from Charlie and Eugene. Welcome to the exchange.
Hi, good morning. Yes, interesting, phosphorus. Once I had a discussion on what was the single most important organism on Earth, and my vote was always rhizobiums. Anyway, there's also very interesting transfers of basic nutrient materials accomplished by large migrations of insects. I've witnessed two in my lifetime. A vast migration of painted ladies, the little red butterflies,
mm-hmm.
In eastern Oregon. Was living deep in eastern Oregon, and it took about a week for this vast mass of painted ladies, butterflies. They had originated in the Southwest somewhere, in the deserts somewhere,
mm-hmm.
and were headed to, you know, only God knows, as it were.
Right.
And if you think about each insect, while minute and carrying only small trace amounts of magnesium, phosphorus, nitrogen, all our basic building block materials, and then magnify it by what? 8 billion butterflies?
Uh-huh.
Or 8 billion? Not 8 billion butterfly sneezes. That's an entirely different.
Okay.
Yeah. But do you know of any research done into that?
That's a good question. Thanks for that, Charlie. Appreciate that. So, Emma, first of all, any about the particularly the aspects of insects carrying the kinds of nutrients that the plants in the Sierra need, is that documented anywhere?
No, I'm not aware of anything like that. I think it's a really interesting thing that he proposes, though. And I think it's more than them carrying the nutrients. It's the fact that those insects are going to die at some point. And so the nutrients that make them up are going to break down through the action of bacteria and fungi and then be recycled and be available into whatever ecosystem they end up in. To my knowledge, that hasn't been studied. It's a very interesting point that your caller just made. And I just want to also agree with him. I do think rhizobium bacteria are some of the most important organisms on Earth. They really allow our agricultural system to not just rely on chemical fertilizers because they can fix nitrogen directly from the air and make that available to plants. So that was a great point that your caller just made.
So the rhizobiums are the nitrogen-fixing bacteria we hear so much about?
Yes, they are. They're one group of them, but the major, the dominant group, and the one that's most likely going to be found associated with legumes, which we might eat for food.
We are you're lighting up the switchboard here, so let's go to Lane in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Emma Aronson. Lane, go ahead.
Hello, this is Lane Watson. So it's a small thing. I was stationed in South Korea for 2.5 years, and a certain time of year, every year, the sky would turn yellow, and we were told it was the dust from the Gobi Desert, which was about 1,500 miles away. Maybe more.
Okay, and it was a cloud there.
West.
It was a really visible cloud to you just there in Korea?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The sky would turn yellow. So it was very distinct. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's an amazing thing. Thanks for sharing that, Lane. Appreciate it. So let's talk about how much material gets pulled up and out of the Gobi Desert and how much then ends up in the likes of California, Emma.
That's a really good point. So I think while I don't have the absolute numbers of the amount of material that's moved each year from the Gobi Desert or around the Gobi Desert, I can say that I think what's hitting the Sierra is a very small proportion of the total amount of dust that's being picked up. It's a vast area, and there's various prevailing winds which will bring that material in various directions. I think the caller also brings up a very interesting point, which is that a lot of people associate dust with negative possibilities, negative things, one of them being air quality. And I think Gobi Desert dust in particular, it does have a negative impact on air quality in various areas in Asia. And the dust we're talking about entering the Sierras, it's at a very high elevation that it's coming in, and it's also not at a high enough density that it's going to necessarily cause any health issues. So that's something for people to realize. We're talking about a relatively low amount of dust. What's so incredible about it is how high in phosphorus it is, and how low the Sierras are in phosphorus, and so how important it is for that to come in. The caller makes an excellent point about the movement of Gobi Desert dust, and my brother actually is teaching English in Korea right now, and I wonder now if he's going to get to see that same dust phenomenon that was just described by your caller.
Well, by all means, tell him to look for it.
I will.
So let me understand that. I mean, we've established that the Sierras are fairly phosphorus poor. Is the Gobi Desert dust fairly phosphorus rich?
Yes. And also, I should mention, we believe that the Central Valley dust is also fairly phosphorus rich. Both sources seemed to be bringing in a lot of phosphorus into the Sierras, up to even more than 50% of the phosphorus that's available each year to these trees might be coming from the dust sources rather than the bedrock. So this is new phosphorus. There's also phosphorus that's just cycling through the ecosystem. Every time a leaf breaks down, the phosphorus that was in that leaf is freed up. So it's not that this is the only source of phosphorus, but it is an important source, and it's bringing in fresh phosphorus for the growth of plants.
Well, so given dust blowing up from the Central Valley, does a drought year with the dust blowing around a bit more, is that helpful for the Sierra?
That's an excellent question. And the grant that funded this work was actually, it's a rapid grant from National Science Foundation that was targeted to be able to pick up that exact signal. We hypothesized that because it was a drought year, we'd be seeing a lot of dust movement. Just because there's so many fallow fields and natural ecosystems weren't able to be as productive as many plants as normal. And so there's a lot of bare soil, which allows for a huge amount of dust being picked up and moved. And so that was the hypothesis that we had. Right now, though, we don't have a wet year that we've compared it to, and so we're in the process of applying for further funding to be able to research a wet year, and then hopefully just 2 years isn't enough to establish a scientific theory, so hopefully we'll be able to do this for several years to come, really get a better understanding of how the interplay is between droughts and wet years in terms of the amount of dust that moves, not just for the Central Valley, because this really could be important in other very nutrient-poor mountain systems all over the world.
So you mentioned that this is one of 10 critical zone observatories, or CZOs, established by the National Science Foundation. How are those places set up in the first place? What makes for a critical zone and an observatory within it?
That's a great question. So the critical zone is a term that was coined, I think, in the last 20 or 30 years. It refers to the active zone of the Earth. And so it's from the highest trees or other organisms down to the lowest groundwater is considered the critical zone. So it's like the living skin of the Earth. And so these other observatories, they all have slightly different questions that they're asking about that critical zone. So in the Sierras, we have one set of questions. In other areas, they're looking into other things. What brings them all together is approaching it from an interdisciplinary standpoint, where you've got hydrologists, ecologists, microbiologists, geomorphologists, you know, isotope geochemists, just like our group. You've got all these different scientists who are coming together to ask questions that if there weren't this nexus of research activity for them to focus on, maybe they would never work together, and maybe some of the most important scientific advances wouldn't be made because there's not a lot of other ways for, you know, geochemists to talk to microbiologists.
It sounds like a rather exciting flurry of work, particularly when you get a chance to talk to people across scientific boundaries.
Absolutely. Oh, yes. It's incredibly dynamic. And, you know, I was just beginning as an assistant professor here at Riverside when I began to be linked into the Critical Zone Observatory through one of my colleagues, Steve Hart, who's also on this paper, is also an incredible ecologist. So, you know, I feel so lucky that I was able to start talking to him and then be connected through him and the Critical Zone Observatory to other scientists who are doing very different things. It's really one of the best ways that scientific innovation moves forward.
And how is it all funded?
It's funded from the National Science Foundation, from the Geosciences Directorate, which is, I think, a really important directorate. It's one that's actually on the chopping block right now. So something, if people like the kind of research that we're doing, you know, they should keep that in mind.
All right. Good to think about. We're talking to Emma Aronson, assistant professor in the Department of Plant Pathology and Microbiology at the University of California, Riverside. If you're looking for the paper, it's called Dust Outpaces Bedrock in Nutrient Supply to Montane Forest Ecosystems. It's in the journal Nature Communications. Dr. Aronson, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure.